Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. From tweet storms to Stormy Daniels, President Trump dominates news headlines. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof calls it a Trump addiction. He admits he's hooked. The cost, Kristof says, is overlooking pressing issues at home and abroad. A life is lost to gun violence every 15 minutes. A domestic opioid crisis rages on. War in Syria and chaos in Gaza. He joins us to take a deep dive into what we've been missing. This hour on Point, Nicholas Kristof's call to open our eyes and see more than Trump. You can join us on air or online. Are you addicted to the Trump headlines? Are you frustrated that other big issues aren't getting covered enough? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll discuss CIA director nominee Gina Haspel ahead of tomorrow's Senate confirmation hearing. But first, joining me from New York City is Nicholas Kristof, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times. His recent op-ed is headlined, Our Addiction to Trump. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Nick Kristof, welcome. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Good to be with you.
Thank you. So your column over the weekend really caught our attention with this notion that because President Trump is getting all the headlines with the Russia probe and Stormy Daniels and the rest, that other important issues at home and abroad are being ignored. You write, quote, news organizations, especially cable news channels, feed off Trump like ox peckers on a rhino's back, for he is part of our business model in 2018, end quote. How do you view this symbiotic relationship into which you say the media and Donald Trump are locked?
Well, boy, it's awkward, isn't it, since we criticize him nonstop, justifiably, and yet he is crucial to our business model. You know, back in 2016, I remember some anxiety in newsrooms because at that point we had huge audiences because of the election, but there was considerable concern that Hillary Clinton would win and then the world would become boring again and our audiences would drop and the business model would erode. And, well, that has not happened. And look, you know, we have to cover President Trump. We are crucial to providing – we, meaning the news media generally, are crucial to providing that kind of accountability. And I don't think there's been a time in my lifetime when this kind of accountability journalism is as important. But – I think we also have to liken this to a multi-front war. And one front is President Trump's assault on institutions and norms in the country. But there are all these other fronts too. I mean, like opioids, genocide in Myanmar, the profound dysfunction in a lot of America. Mm-hmm. And we have to keep bandwidth alive to keep those – keep attention on those issues, because if we don't keep a spotlight on them, then they just simply won't get addressed.
Let me play this clip from comedian Michelle Wolf. This is from the White House Correspondents' Dinner in April. She went after the media for their obsession with Donald Trump.
He couldn't sell steaks or vodka or water or college or ties or Eric. He has helped you. He's helped you sell your papers and your books and your TV. You helped create this monster, and now you're profiting off of him.
You helped create this monster, now you're profiting off him. You write, Nicholas Kristof, that, quote, in America today, it's all about Trump all the time. We're collectively addicted to him. The nonstop scandals, the outrages suck us in. They amount to Trump porn, end quote. You also write that you're addicted yourself. What's the conflict you have as a journalist and as a person as you cover this particular president?
Well, so as a journalist, you know, I know that I can just about hit an F5 key and a anti-Trump column will pour out and it will get huge traction and a lot of readers. Or I can travel halfway around the world to, for example, try to cover the genocide against the Rohingya, and my audience will decline. And, you know, I'm at this point, I'm at a stage in my career when I'm perfectly happy to do that, to lose audiences. The Times has been incredibly good about letting me write columns that only my mother will read. But I do think that there is a real challenge, and maybe especially for cable television, partly because they have real metrics about exactly how many people are watching at any one moment. And frankly, if you're the executive producer of a cable TV show, you know that you can, you know, you can send a camera crew off to cover opioids in West Virginia or, you know, some crisis further afield. Or you can put – but if you do that, your audience will drop compared to a rival network that puts a Democrat and a Republican in a studio together and has them yell at each other. And that is a – that is particularly problematic at a time when the business model for much of journalism is collapsing and we are not really sure what is going to replace it.
I can hear Trump supporters out there right now saying – here is a progressive East Coast elite bashing Trump. More Trump bashing. Here we go. Nicholas Kristof, you know, is it easy to blame Trump? Would we really be solving the opioid crisis if it wasn't for Donald Trump? Would we be solving health care? Would we be looking at Syria more clearly, Iran? I mean, would we be solving all these problems if it wasn't for Donald Trump? Is it too easy to blame this president because of his very unique, shall we say, style? Is it fair?
Well, so we have longstanding problems that go back for many, many decades. I mean, a child in the U.S. is 70% more likely to die before the age of 18 than a child in other OECD advanced countries. And that's been a problem that is 50 years in the making. Likewise, our response to opioids and other drugs both Portugal and the U.S. were looking at this issue in the 1990s. The U.S. doubled down on a mass incarceration, a criminal justice response to drugs. And while Portugal responded with a public health approach, today Portugal has the lowest drug overdose rate in Western Europe. And we had 65,000 Americans die last year of drugs. So you're absolutely right. And the Trump supporters are absolutely right that he did not create these problems. On the other hand, I do think that – and in fact, I must say he was elected in part because of them. I think there was tremendous distress around the country and especially among the white working class. And there, that's one reason I think some of those votes shifted. But I don't. I also think that President Trump is magnifying some of those issues. You know, that healthcare issue that I mentioned, the fact that American kids are 70% more likely to die than those in other OECD countries. Well, that becomes a bigger problem when you undermine the model of the Affordable Care Act, when you place obstacles in the way of expanding Medicaid, when you take reproductive health money like Title X and allocate it away from effective programs like Planned Parenthood and allocate it toward abstinence-only programs that, frankly, have been pretty much shown not very effective.
So as I hear you speak, I remember what Bill Gates said on CBS this morning a few months ago. Here he is last September answering the question about what concerns him most about the direction the United States is moving in.
If you had a huge turn inwards and you said, okay, we don't care that the HIV epidemic goes and explodes in Africa, we don't care that they have good health care there, you know, a pandemic can start there and go and spread to the world. So the good news about the increased stability in education and health, all of that could go into reverse if we're too self-centered.
Too self-centered. Nicholas Kristof, you've written, you write that we complain about Trump being insular and parochial, but we've become insular and parochial as well, you say. We've caught the contagion that we mock. I hear similar themes between what you're saying and what Bill Gates is saying, being too self-centered, sort of insular. What's your evidence of that?
Well, if you look at news coverage, but it's more than just news coverage, it's kind of the national conversation, then there really isn't the same interest in some of these global issues, and they tend to arise only when Americans are directly affected. So in the case of Syria, you've had about 500,000 people killed in this just horrific war, but it has received intermittent attention when Americans are kidnapped and executed. A few years ago, it did get some attention when Aleppo was being bombarded. These days, with Eastern Ghouta, it really only received attention when the U.S. was, debating whether to have a military response. And indeed, I think that more and more we're seeing the world and covering the world and paying attention to the world only as it relates to a prism of American involvement or a possible military conflict. And that we're not paying attention to some of these larger issues, especially about health. If you think back to the Ebola crisis of some years ago, that was handled effectively in part because the U.S., Britain, and France worked together to stop the epidemic. If a similar Ebola crisis were to erupt today, I don't think that there would be the international response, partly because there wouldn't be as much international attention. And in that case, indeed, it might ripple around the world.
In fact, Bill Gates has warned that one of our top risks globally is a pandemic for which we are ill-prepared.
Yeah. One of the challenges is that in the media, we are pretty good at covering what happens on any given moment. So if there is a press conference, if there is a missile fired, if there is an outrageous statement, then we're on it. We're pretty good at that. What we're, I think, least good at covering is the things that happen every day. Malaria, maternal deaths, malnutrition. So more than one-fifth of kids worldwide are stunted from malnutrition. Because it happens every day, it's not news on any one day, and so we tend to miss it, and so it tends not to be addressed.
We'll dig into some of those important issues after this break with Nicholas Kristof, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times. You can link to his recent op-ed headlined Our Addiction to Trump. It's at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes life is exactly like the movies.
T-minus 30 seconds.
They said T-minus.
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy and sometimes about rocket ships.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're discussing New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof's take on America's Trump addiction, and you can join the conversation. Does the idea of a Trump obsession ring true for you? What are the issues affecting you or afflicting you that are getting lost in the endless cycles of Trump coverage? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. My guest this hour, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist. His recent op-ed is headlined, Our Addiction to Trump. We're talking about all different things, all different issues, news events around the world. Here are a couple. Here's a report from CBS News last month on the war in Yemen.
For nearly 3 years, Saudi Arabia has been backing these Yemeni government soldiers, fighting a brutal war against Houthi rebels who have seized swaths of land.
And U.S. and Jordanian forces recently trained for the possibility that ISIS might take over a refugee camp in Syria on Jordan's border. Here's CNN's Ben Wiedemann. He covered that.
This is Eager Lion 2018, Jordanian-American war games in the desert. The troops are simulating an assault on an imaginary refugee camp that has fallen under the control of extremists.
Nicholas Kristof, got a lot of great calls here. I want to get a couple. First, Mary in Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Mary. You're on with Nicholas Kristof.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. I enjoy very much his columns, by the way. My concern is not so much worldwide. It's local, and local meaning very local, meaning statewide local, meaning national local.
Okay.
The more we see and hear of Donald Trump, the more likely he is to get elected again. And it doesn't matter whether there's negative commentary. And I think that you should look at the situation with Blankenship. I don't know what will happen with this election, but I don't even know the names of the Republicans who are running against him.
Because he's gotten so much press, yeah.
And I know the situation quite well, and it concerns me tremendously, but it's the same kind of thing. There he is all the time. And I heard a comment this morning on the news that someone said, he'll get our jobs back. Mm. Oh, man.
Mary, thank you very much for that input and for your call there in Iowa. Let's go to Debbie in Tennessee, Murfreesboro. Hi, Debbie. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I called to comment on thankful that Mr. Kristof has brought this to light, because I am sick and every single day I hear the name Trump on the news. It's just a big soap opera, and I agree with him and Michelle Wolf that the media has cashed in on this soap opera. But full disclosure, I'm not a Trump fan, and the Trump fans who say, oh, we blame him for everything, we blame every president for everything.
Debbie, thank you. Maybe a little bit more so this one, I would argue. Yes, Nicholas, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say also in regard to Mary's point, she mentioned local news. And I really do think that that is one of the big problems we face as a country, because the business model for local news has really completely collapsed. And while Trump is buttressing the model for national news organizations, that's not helping local TV stations or local newspapers around the country. And it is kind of heartbreaking to travel around and to see the Denver Post is going through this right now, but great papers like the Baltimore Sun or Miami Herald or my original hometown paper, The Oregonian, mm-hmm. that are just struggling. And I guess I fear that if local news organizations aren't robust and can't invest in really dogging local officials and providing accountability, then in many of these places there isn't a robust opposition party that is in a position to do it. And so then accountability is simply lost. And we don't know what is going to replace that. I mean, it may be that philanthropy is going to be the new model for that kind of local journalism. But this is a bigger problem than Trump. And while Trump is, we're the oxpeckers on Trump's back nationally,
yeah.
It doesn't help the local level.
I see. And yet you write in your piece that nationally, every time Trump bashes the media, calls it fake news, your subscriptions increase.
Yeah. He is sort of toxic to civility. I massively disapprove of these tweets. I think he undermines norms of democracy. But on the other hand, boy, I sure wish he would send out a toxic tweet denouncing me because it would, it certainly would bring me more readers. And that is what is happening to news organizations around the country. And there's a certain amount of, competition among news organizations to see who can be denounced more.
So let me tick through some of the items you mentioned in your column. If we're trying to sort of pull the blinds away and look outside of Trump coverage, American life expectancy, fallen for 2 years in a row. Guns, claim a life every 15 minutes, and the number of uninsured is rising again, even as a child in the U.S. is 70 times more likely to die before adulthood.
70%.
70% more
times.
Likely yeah. to die before adulthood than someone in other advanced nations. Give us a sense of what we should be looking at right now. What are you watching out there, Nicholas Kristof? What should we have our eyes on?
So there is a growing evidence that we took kind of a 50-year wrong turn in the U.S. on some crucial policies. We were the leader in the world in terms of high school graduation rates as recently as the 1960s. Now we rank 23rd. In healthcare, we were among the leaders in the 1960s. Now we are way down the pack. And mortality has, as reflecting in the fact that life expectancy has fallen. In every other advanced country, its life expectancy is improving. In the U.S., it's dropping, partly because of suicides, which are at a 30-year high, and partly because of opioids. And so I think there is a really, you know, some profound dysfunction going on, and that some of the things that would address it are the kinds of issues that aren't getting attention because they're not particularly politicized. I think, you know, if you had to search for ways that could improve the situation, I think there's pretty good evidence that early childhood interventions are one of the best ways to break cycles of poverty. But while there are vigorous debates about K-12 education or about financing college, or about our Secretary of Education and grizzly bears, there isn't really a debate about early childhood education. There's something closer to a consensus on it. And so as a result, we don't really talk about it. And I'm afraid that we've let President Trump define the agenda in ways that undermine our ability to respond and use policy tools that would actually help make a difference on some of these broad national problems.
Let me focus your attention on guns. You write a lot about guns, really as a public health issue. You take the morality out of it, Nicholas Kristof. You frame it in a way that you might talk about controlling disease. In your most recent column, you write, guns claim a life every 15 minutes in this country. I want to play this clip from the NRA. They held their annual meeting in Dallas this last weekend. In an interview with USA Today, community activist Dominique Alexander told reporters that he wants the NRA to stop pushing back against sensible gun laws.
That blood is on your hand if you don't do anything about it. We want the NRA to stop pushing back against sensible gun laws. Stop pushing back on background checks, on automatic assault rifles, bunk stocks, all of those things that are sensible.
What are we missing in this particular conversation, in this debate, Nicholas Kristof?
I think we're missing a real focus on evidence and on what is plausible. And gun advocates will regularly tell me, look, cars kill about as many people in America each year as guns do, and we don't ban cars. No, but we do regulate cars and access to cars to dramatically reduce their lethality. So since 1921, we have reduced the auto fatality rate per 100 million miles driven by 95%. And we didn't do that with any one thing, but we did it with seatbelts and airbags and better bumpers and padded dashboards, by requiring driver's licenses, by having graduated licenses for young drivers, by cracking down on drunk driving, by engineering roads better. And I think that's kind of a model for how we take a dangerous product that is a part of American life and try to make it safer. And in, you know, one of the great lessons of automobiles is that you limit access to people who will be dangerous. And so drunk drivers, for example, or young people, or in recent years there's been a push to get the elderly out from behind the wheel. And these are difficult and they're incomplete and they don't work perfectly. But certainly one lesson is that we need universal background checks for guns. And yet still 20% of guns are acquired in America without going through a universal background check.
Let me get Charles in here from Providence, okay. Rhode Island, Nick. Charles, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's so much America's addicted to Trump stuff as it is the media spoon-feeding it to us day and night. And mainly, I think, it's because it's cheap product. Nobody has to go out and investigate anything. You just sit some people down. They can all be on one side of an issue or all against or evenly divided. But it's all speculation. Well, what if we pull out – what if Trump and company pulls out of whatever this accord, whatever that accord, whatever treaty this is? Well, that might happen. No, this might happen. No, this could happen.
Mm-hmm.
BBC covered that last night in 30 seconds.
and moved on. Yeah. Charles, thank you. Let me, you know, I see Rob here on our website somewhat agreeing with you. This is one of those situations where one might expect that people be responsible for their media consumption or fact-checking, but they don't. Let's go to Lori in Asheville, North Carolina. Hi, Lori. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I love you, Mr. Kristof. Read you all the time. I totally
thank
agree
you.
With you. Think the media has really overlooked really important things. You've listed many of them. I'd like to throw in the environment as the thing I'm always looking for news on. But I don't believe that we're addicted. I personally am just afraid of looking away. And that's why I'm constantly watching this. It's like having a dangerous animal in your yard. You know, you just have to keep an eye on it.
You're worried about
keeping an eye on him, but he's not the only thing out there.
Lori, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead, Nick.
Let me make a couple of comments. So, in terms of whether the basic problem is the media or the basic problem is the audience, I do think there's plenty of blame to go around. And I think it's pretty clear that when news organizations and especially cable TV turn and cover other subjects, then audiences drop. And that's a really kind of hard problem, but I think it's true. And I get metrics on my New York Times columns, and I was struck that right after I wrote my Sunday column about our obsession with Trump, mm-hmm. I happened to get the page views for my last Thursday column, which was about sexual violence around the world. And it was one of the worst read columns that I've written in recent times. And, again, I'm perfectly happy to write columns that nobody reads, and because I'm at a sort of a stage in my career when I can do that. But if you're the young, ambitious executive producer of a TV show, you don't have that luxury. And this is a genuine hard problem, and part of it's going to involve better storytelling. But it's genuinely kind of a really difficult problem.
Let me get Anna in here from Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Anna. You're on the air with Nicholas Kristof. Hi, nice to have you.
Thank you. I agree with Mary and Charles as far as what I've heard, that he really is, Trump, I say, is really a media hound. And good or bad, he's still getting attention. It's just like when I was in the classroom, bullies want attention. So the more attention he gets, good or bad, he's still getting attention, getting the name recognition.
Anna, thank you. I'm gonna jump off. I want to get Ken in here before we have to leave. Ken in Huntland, Tennessee, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. All your previous callers have hit on a lot of the things I was going to talk about with regard to the cheap coverage and the news media feeding off itself in a paparazzi kind of a style. As far as some of the issues that don't get covered, one of the things that I always want to mention on the air, and nobody ever gives me an opportunity to, is most of the problems that we face in humanity are related to overpopulation. I mean, if we had 4 billion people on this planet instead of 7.5 billion people, a lot of the health care issues, a lot of the crime issues, the many of the issues that we deal with would be. And nobody ever talks about it.
Ken, thank you. You know, it's an idea for another show. We just have 2 minutes with Nick Kristof, and I'm going to let you take the microphone here and leave us with your thoughts after this terrific column over the weekend about our addiction to Trump, our obsession with Trump. What would you have us know, Nick, as we go out of here now?
So, as I think about issues that are undercovered, I do think that there's a systematic pattern that the issues that we in America are worst at developing policies toward are those that are hardest to talk about for one reason or another. Mm. Maybe it's because they involve sex, which always is kind of an awkward conversation, or sexual violence, or because they involve a certain amount of shame, or mental health, for example. Just a huge
right.
national problem
right.
that clearly we're under-addressing. Domestic violence. And the news media should be trying to break some of these taboos, should be trying to cover some of these difficult issues. But I think we in the media have to figure out how to simultaneously provide real accountability over President Trump and cover the incredibly important things that he is doing. I certainly don't think we should abandon him, but also save some bandwidth for these larger issues at home and abroad. And I don't think we're doing that. I think we have been too content to let him define the agenda, to let him bring in audiences. And we're, I think a lot of us went into journalism because we thought that it plays an important role in society, it provides some accountability. I think we aren't doing as good a job as we should, with plenty of wonderful exceptions. And I think that it's fair for audiences to hold us accountable and demand a better job from all of us.
Nicholas Kristof is a Pulitzer Prize-winning winning columnist for The New York Times. Wrote a great piece, Our Addiction to Trump. It's on our website, onpointradio.org. Nick Kristof, thank you very much for your insights and for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
After the break, a look ahead at the confirmation battle for CIA director nominee Gina Haspel. You can join the conversation on that. Should Gina Haspel be the next CIA director? If you could ask her a question at tomorrow's Senate hearing, what would it be? We'll get to that after the break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. Gina Haspel goes before the Senate Intelligence Committee tomorrow. It's the first step in her quest to be the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency. She's expected to be pressed on her role in the CIA torture program, among other things. You can join the conversation, listeners. Should Gina Haspel be the next director of the CIA? Do you have concerns? If not her, who? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Here is Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California expressing her concerns about Gina Haspel on NBC's Nightly News. This was from Sunday.
It's very concerning because those of us that worked on the torture report know some things. They're classified. And this is an important part of this woman's career.
And Fox News' Melissa Francis asked Republican Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri, who sits on the Senate Intelligence Committee, to respond to concerns about Gina Haspel's history with torture that Dianne Feinstein referred to there. This is yesterday.
She's done a great job in the agency. In terms of the things that the CIA was told to do and told were legal to do at the time, that's, of course, what you'd expect the CIA to be able to do. I think she's actually more than any other person that might be nominated likely to ask the tough questions about, are you sure we've covered every base here? Are you sure that the Justice Department has come up with the right conclusion?
Joining me now from Washington is Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Nahal, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, it's good to be back.
Great to have you. Joining me also from Washington, Nafisa Saeed, national security reporter for Bloomberg. Nafisa, great to have you.
Hi, Jane.
So, Nahal, what will you be listening for at Gina Haspel's hearing tomorrow, Wednesday?
Well, I'm going to be particularly paying attention to the questions that the Democratic senators ask and how far they're willing to push her on the elements of the torture program that she was involved with. And I'm going to be really intrigued to see whether she tries to dodge any questions. I think a lot of her life has basically been undercover and classified, so it'll be interesting to see how much sunshine she's willing to allow to shine on it.
So, Nafisa, speak more about that, because as Nahal mentioned, Gina Haspel has been a spy for 32 years. I think much of her life remains a mystery. So this will be a very unusual confirmation hearing. Tell us a little bit about Gina Haspel's career, what we know about it.
Tomorrow is going to be sort of a public debut. We're really going to get to hear from her after there's been a lot of debate and discussion around her and her past. Like you said, she has really spent the last 33 years undercover. She was head of clandestine service, also head of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. And so, you know, ever since she was nominated by President Donald Trump to replace Mike Pompeo, who is now the Secretary of State, the CIA has been sort of, you know, disclosing and declassifying certain things about her past, trying to, frame her as this girl from Kentucky who joined the CIA and then, you know, had all this, you know, illustrious career. Her first day at the Counterterrorism Center, they say, was on 9/11, and so she had a big role in that. But at the same time, the bits that we have heard about her from reporting from different outlets around her time, you know, as the head of what is called a CIA black site in Thailand. And so I think a lot of questions around what her role and how much she knew, and also allegedly being involved in the destruction of tapes of those interrogations. I think, like Nihal was saying, it's really going to be part of what we hear tomorrow. And so she's been kind of slowly coming out publicly. She was on the Hill yesterday, so we got a look at her sort of going to meeting with some of even her critics, like Dianne Feinstein. So we'll get to hear straight from her tomorrow, which, you know, something we haven't really heard before.
So, Nihal, Democrats and some Republicans, including John McCain, Senator Rand Paul, have been critical of Gina Haspel for her role in this waterboarding program of terrorism suspects at a secret CIA, quote, black site prison in Thailand. Tell us about this place, why it was set up, and Gina Haspel's role there.
Well, this is, you know, a part of the arrangement after 9/11 when the Bush administration really felt like they had to take the gloves off, well, metaphorically speaking, and apparently literally to some extent, and they wanted to have a way to interrogate suspects in secret places that allowed them to get information on what al-Qaeda and affiliated terrorist networks were up to. And, you know, what was intriguing at the time, of course, was that the administration interpreted U.S. laws and U.S. agreements, international agreements, in a particular way that made it, their interpretation was that it was legal to do things like waterboard suspects. They said it was enhanced interrogation, that it wasn't torture. And for Democrats, this is a real issue because they have long thought that it was unacceptable, and they worry that if you put someone like Gina Haspel at the top of the CIA, you're sending a signal to the rest of the world, including the Muslim world, that the U.S. still does condone torture. And, you know, one of the things that's really interesting is that Haspel and Pompeo and others have said, look, you know, torture is illegal. You guys have passed laws in Congress to say that it's illegal, and so we're going to follow the law. But ultimately, as the Bush administration years proved, it depends on how you interpret the law. It depends on how you define something. And if you label waterboarding as something that isn't torture, then you can say it's legal. And I think for a lot of Democrats, they feel like they've been burned in the past by this, and they don't want to be burned again.
Mm. So, Nafisa, the CIA videotaped the torture, as you mentioned, and then those tapes were destroyed. Will you talk about that and Gina Haspel's possible involvement in that? Was that a problem?
That's a kind of a key point there in terms of, you know, what her involvement was. As I mentioned, the CIA has been sort of giving us breadcrumbs of, like, certain things that she was involved in, and not necessarily, you know, all of the kinds of things that she did during her career. But one of the interesting things that they decided or chose to declassify was a memo from the former deputy director of the CIA, Mike Morrell. And in that 2011 memo, he said that he made a decision not to discipline Gina Haspel for her role in destroying the tapes. And so it's kind of a long story, but basically he's saying that she sort of wrote a memo ordering for the destruction of the tapes under the guidance of who would have been her boss at that time, the director of the National Clandestine Service named Jose Rodriguez. So they were trying to show that she did this, you know, from orders and also from, you know, legal advice that she was getting at that time. And so it wasn't something that she kind of nefariously did in terms of, you know, the information that they've disclosed to us. But, you know, a lot of people I've talked to, even former intelligence officials, will say, but she still knew what was happening and what had happened, and she was involved in the destruction of those tapes. Basically, they were shredded, and that would have been around 2005. So the question is, how much did she know, and how much did she think that this could have been, you know, sort of, you know, destruction of evidence of what actually happened at that time?
Well, to be clear, Nihal, the Justice Department investigated the tape destruction, but did not order any charges to be filed here.
Right. And I think this is part of the thing. You know, some people say that the U.S. has never really gone through, like, a truth and reconciliation process on this whole part of its history and the CIA's role
in torture. But, you know, there are, of course, people within the CIA and on former CIA officials who are get really frustrated when you bring these things up, because they say, look, you know, the politicians are the ones who set the rules. We follow their guidelines. We are, you know, civil servants to a degree who follow orders based on whatever administration is in charge. So it really frustrates them that someone like Gina could be held responsible for in many ways were the decisions of a presidential administration, the Bush administration in this case. Haspel has a lot of support within the agency, and people who were former CIA officials, they speak very highly of her. But I think also there are some of them who feel frustrated because they understand the symbolic situation of this, putting someone like her in charge of this program. But at the same time, again, they're like, look, you know, we were just doing what we were told was legal mm-hmm. by the president's own advisors.
Let me get Chad in here, a caller in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Chad. I'm glad you called. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. It stands to reason that she's qualified. She's a number two person right now. I mean, if she did something wrong, illegal, that's one thing. But I was in the military for 14 years. You follow orders. If somebody gives you an order, you follow them. If it's illegal, you can't litigate the past. I mean, you can't continually go back and say, well, you know, looking at it now, 20 years later, mm-hmm. 10 years later, mm-hmm. you know, where does it end?
Mm-hmm. Chad, thank you. Nafisa, it's not to diminish anything about this very seemingly distinguished career of Gina Haspel.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, the White House and the CIA, the administration, a lot of Republicans on the Senate Intelligence Committee, you know, have been saying she's somebody who you would want there at this time. Even people who are critics of Trump, such as CIA Director John Brennan, the former Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, they've all kind of loudly endorsed her. And so they're saying, you know, even if this is, you know, they don't necessarily agree with the president, they think this is someone you want leading this agency. She's a career spy. So this is somebody you would want in that position and leading. And so that's from, you know, their perspective. And then there's, you know, people like Dan Feinstein who've said, but if you might be sending a wrong message, if someone who has been associated with those torture programs, you know, to be now heading the agency.
Here's Quinn in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Quinn. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Yes, I think that this nominee would be absolutely perfect to represent the CIA.
Because?
The history of the CIA in its, you know, coups in South America, interference in foreign elections, torture, extrajudicious actions against non-citizens and citizens alike matches exactly to her experience in the CIA. And if that's the tool that the CIA is going to be, is a tool of American imperialism, then I think she would be the perfect fit for that. Now, what we want is for the CIA to be a different representation and to do something different. I think she's a terrible fit. If we're looking for a CIA that actually protects America while staying true to our values, then I don't think she has that. But for the way the CIA is now, absolutely perfect.
I hear you, and thank you very much for the call. Senator John McCain has a different opinion, Quinn. He has sent written questions for Gina Haspel about the techniques that were used under her leadership. And these are his words. Those techniques compromised our values, stained our national honor, and threatened our historic reputation. Here is Republican Senator Rand Paul speaking to Face the Nation's Margaret Brennan back in March. He opposes the nomination of Gina Haspel.
There's enough votes, she'll mm-hmm. eventually win. But there are a few things in life where it is worth standing up and saying, enough is enough. This is wrong. This mm-hmm. is, you know, this is beneath contempt. We are not a people that should be so fearful or so vengeful that we think that torture is somehow acceptable.
Nafisa, I suspect at these confirmation hearings, we will hear Gina Haspel have to answer questions about whether she would agree to reinstate waterboarding, as the president has suggested, and whether she believes that torture is an effective way to extract information from terror suspects.
Right. These questions are definitely going to be, I think, front and center tomorrow. And how she responds, I think, is really going to determine how some people who haven't necessarily come out and said whether they're voting for her or not, such as Mark Warner and others who are, you know, kind of on the fence right now, perhaps waiting to see how she actually performs. So if she comes out and condemns it, perhaps, and you know, just says that she's not going to revive those tactics, maybe that'll reassure some people. But for other lawmakers, you know, given her past and what she's associated with, that still might not be enough.
Let's get Tim in here from Rapid City, South Dakota. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I just have a very quick comment.
Okay.
And it's simply kind of following up on a prior caller, and it's there's so much emphasis on this one aspect of a career that we're missing the fact that she's going to be leading a highly complex matrix organization, and she clearly is the most qualified to do that. And in an environment where a lot of people are being pointed to positions where they don't have experience, we should be happy that there's someone like her that,
Tim,
that could fill this position.
I'm glad you called to get that in. I will bookend what you're saying to Nihal. More than 50 former U.S. national security officials and lawmakers have written letters of support endorsing Gina Haspel. Tell us about those letters and that support.
Well, that's the thing, is that many of them say that, look, she's very qualified, that there's a lot to her perhaps that people don't know, but that they are aware of, that they're very confident in her. It's worth noting, though, you know, it's not just a matter of having someone like Gina Haspel lead the CIA. It's the fact that the President of the United States has himself spoken in favor of things like waterboarding, and he said he wanted to bring back a hell of a lot worse than waterboarding. And so, you know, Democrats are thinking if you have someone like Gina Haspel in charge and the president who has said these things, what kind of a combination is that going to lead to? But the other side of it, and some Democrats are definitely thinking about this right now, is, well, if you don't pick someone from within the agency who knows this culture, who's respected by the agency, who could Trump end up nominating? And there's some concern that he might find someone that the Democrats and perhaps, you know, even the CIA and national security establishment consider to be a far worse possibility, someone who's even more likely to pursue policies that Democrats and others just disagree with. So they're thinking that as well. And so when you're a Democrat and you see all these people sending you letters, you know, these prominent established intelligence and other leaders, you know, many of whom definitely don't even agree with Trump, and they're saying, look, Gina is a good person, you should agree with her and vote for her, that puts a lot of pressure on Democrats because they know where the president stands on these things as well.
So, Nafisha, wrap us up here. Will she have the votes? Will she be confirmed? What do you see?
She needs at least one Democrat to win confirmation because she doesn't have Rand Paul's vote. She doesn't have, and John McCain is away. And we've already had several Democratic senators like Sheldon Whitehouse, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Senator Heinrich saying that they're opposing her. So she's really going to have to win over at least one of the Democrats to get to clinch this vote.
All right. We'll be watching Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Thank you very much for being here today. Appreciate it, Nihal.
Thank you.
And Nafisha Saeed, national security reporter at Bloomberg. I appreciate your time, Nafisha. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsanis, Allison Poli, Catherine Proctor, Tanya Raleigh, and James Ross. Coming up tomorrow, reaction from Washington and around the world to President Trump's decision on the Iran deal. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.